Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
I'm going to attempt to start in Italian. Ciao a tutti, and welcome to a new season, sort of. We still haven't quite finished the previous season, but anyway, this is a new season of, well, I'm calling it Past Apocalypse, or Pastor Apocalypse. We're focusing on the post-apocalyptic films of Italian cinema. However, I'm stretching the definition slightly with this first film.
A little bit.
Which comes in a good 20 years earlier than all the rest. But I thought it was kind of a good place to start. And also, I couldn't fit it into our last sci-fi season because that one was Italians in Space. And so this sci-fi season is very much about Italians on Earth. Mm-hmm. In some kind of future where it's not necessarily that there's been an apocalypse, because a few of the films we're going to do, they're not all set in a nuclear wasteland. It's more kind of dystopian future, I suppose.
This definitely fits into the dystopian world.
So it's a kind of dystopian season of films where the future hasn't really worked out all that well, which, let's be honest, I think is pretty much all films set in the future. Just in general, there are very few where the future is great.
This is true. There are a few films you could point to where there are minor differences between current day and the future being depicted, and those minor differences are where the focus becomes, because it's more of a question of, you know, how do things, it's always a question of how do things that we see in modern day, what are the possibilities of them continuing on into the future? What would it look like? And so if it's a small thing, you're obviously trying to focus on something that you fear that is possibly rather small today but may grow in the future. But that's the joy of science fiction, is it's very malleable.
Absolutely. And so I still haven't done this yet. I need to do a new remix of our theme tune. So, I mean, what for you is the sound of dystopian future Italian style?
Well, it's something, it's a synthesizer that's attempting to sound like a theremin, but somehow they couldn't quite nail down the theremin sound, and so it's even stranger, essentially.
Okay. I'll see what I can do. I think I need a few pew 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 pews.
Definitely the handheld weapon that makes a sound that is not quite a gun.
I'll throw a few pew pews in, see what I can do this afternoon. So just in terms of news, I'm just going to remind everybody, because I finally actually got round to having a look, and if you go to malombrafilms.com, you can now order the Blu-ray of The Sex of Angels on their website. So I think last time I said you had to do it through Facebook, but I was just not really doing my research. So anyway, it's available to pre-order on their website, And it does list in the extras that there is a commentary track by the two of us, so it is official.
Oh, and I guess so, we should, I hate to complicate things, but we should probably say our names.
Yeah, so it says there is a commentary track by Adrian Smith and Rod Barnett.
Correct. Ah, there we go. So we've identified ourselves at the top of the show. We're normal podcasters, we swear.
Oh, you know, I always forget to do that. Yeah, in fact, I haven't even welcomed you. Hello, everybody. Let's start again. Let's just ignore this previous 5 minutes. Hi, everybody. Welcome to the show. My name is Adrian Smith, and I would like to welcome the co-host of choice, Rod Barnett.
Hello, Adrian. How are you doing today?
Good. I don't know if I've got to say all that other stuff again now. Let's just take that as read.
We could you could just move it around in the edit or leave it the way it is and have people think of us as what we are.
Yeah, amateurs. Well, one amateur and one podcast professional, which of course, but it's the amateur doing the editing on this one.
That's quite all right. And trust me, I don't know if, you know, what 13 years of doing this paints me as some kind of professional, but it does paint me as someone with a lot of experience. That's about as far as I'm willing to go.
Yeah, 13 years. That's pretty impressive.
Yeah, yeah. It is. It has been. It has been 13 years. The first show I the first podcast I created was the very first episode of the NashyCast, and it came out in late January or early February of 2010. So yeah. Yeah.
Well, when people didn't even know what podcasts really were.
Yeah, I know. I mean, the inspiration for me was other podcasts, but I was aware at the time that almost no one knew what the hell I was talking about. So,
yes, whereas now you can't move without bumping into somebody who's got their own podcast. Mm-hmm. But anyway, here we are. So, yeah, future dystopian Italian cinema. And we are starting with probably, it's certainly one of the most significant early dystopian future films. I don't think it's necessarily the first, but, or maybe it is. I don't know. Anyway.
From the Italians, it might be. I don't know.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, yes. Yeah, certainly not necessarily in terms of all of cinema, but... Would we
count Alphaville as a dystopian film?
Well, that is a great question. And so I'll get to it later on, but I've got some reviews of this film when it came out. And it is compared with Alphaville. In fact, when I was re-watching this, I was thinking of Alphaville a lot, which because it came out the same year. So this, of course, is The Tenth Victim, La Decima Victima. By Elio Petri. And so, yeah, 1965, it's right in the middle of the pop art explosion. And boy, if ever a film could be described as being a pop art film, it's this one.
Certainly, yes.
It's just fabulous to watch, isn't it? Like, you just, your eyes are just being blasted all the way through the film with amazing colors and funky art. And plastic, uncomfortable looking furniture.
Yeah. It's also often kind of amazing to revisit what the people of the 1960s, especially the filmmakers, thought the future was going to look like. Now, you know, we're still not there, but the spare rooms, identifiable but definitely odd furniture and wall hangings and expressions of personal interest around different things.
It's really amazing. And I love the giant blinking eye in the background of Marcello's house. And it's just there for no reason. It's just there.
Well, that's just it. I kept thinking that some of these things are seem to be just kind of visual references to classic dystopians literature of different types. That eye seems to just put me in mind of Big Brother from 1984 and you know other kinds of things like that. But there's a lot of that kind of stuff in this movie, and I was interested in how effectively it does that without ever drawing attention to it, because it this thing is 90 minutes long, and I've seen a lot of complaints from contemporary reviews about it flagging, basically questioning its ability to keep up its pace. And I was just like, I don't know if it's just me, but I was constantly, you know, my eyes are darting around the screen at all times, even when action isn't happening. So I don't know.
Oh, it's great. It's like spending an hour and a half in a museum of modern art, whilst also at the same time watching a travel log about ancient Rome on your phone.
Oh, I know. Done by helicopter. That helicopter view of Rome in the mid '60s was that's quite an. That's quite an interesting thing to have on film, regardless of what you think of the film that you're watching.
And it's interesting that you mentioned Alphaville, because obviously in that film he just shoots it in contemporary Paris, but says, this is the future and we're on another planet. And he somehow, Godard makes Paris seem kind of strangely sci-fi without really doing very much. And it's quite similar here, that even when they're out and about in regular streets in New York or Rome, they still managed to give it that sort of sci-fi element, so you still do feel like this could be the future, even though they're driving basically 60s cars
some odd looking 60s cars at times.
And I guess the clothing as well, the costumes are fantastic. Also, giving Marcello Mastroianni bleached hair adds a kind of sci-fi edge to it, I think.
Definitely gives him a different look, and I do like that in the dialogue they have one of the women in the film register clearly that he's peroxided his hair. I like that.
It's so good. So where should we start? Perhaps before we get into the plot, I have to make a confession. Again, like, I'm so inexperienced with a lot of this stuff that I have not seen any of Elio Petri's other films. But he's, I tell a lie. I've seen one of his other films.
Which one have you seen?
I've seen is it called A Quiet Place in the Country?
Yes, excellent movie.
With Franco Nero.
And Vanessa Redgrave.
And Vanessa Redgrave. So, I do know that film, and that was really entertaining.
I have to admit, I only know two, and that is one of them. Because of the heavy award status of the film that he did right after A Quiet Place in the Country, Investigation of a Citizen Above Suspicion. I saw it years ago, and it is a fantastic film.
Yeah, and I did recently buy that, but I still haven't watched it. So,
you've got a treat in front of you. It's good.
Yeah. I also do own the Blu-ray that Arrow put out years ago of his first film, I think it was, L'Assassino.
I've never
killer.
Seen that. Yeah.
No, I still haven't watched it. It's sitting on my shelf. So I'm very neglectful. And also he's made a lot of movies. His film, The Working Class Goes to Heaven, just recently got a release here in the UK by a new company called Radiance Films.
Yeah.
Which is run by the guy who used to work for Arrow. And now he's got his own new company. So it seems like Elio Petri is getting more and more stuff out there and more recognition. But he's made a lot of films, and I'm very... inexperienced, sadly. So I do need to watch, especially like you said, the Investigation of a I've already forgot what it's called.
Investigation of a Citizen Above Suspicion. It's very good. The thing about that is, and we will talk a little bit about this as we talk about this particular film, I have to say the intentional jibes, the in this film, in 10th Victim, you might talk about it as satire, maybe, but in Investigation of a Citizen Above Suspicion, we're definitely talking about harsh commentary about the society in which the story takes place. And it also makes me really curious. There's one of his films that I've wanted to see for a while because I've heard some people recommend it highly, but I've never been able to catch a copy of it in English anywhere, called We Still Kill the Old Way. Just reading the description of it, I'm thinking, well, first of all, I love the cast, and I'm thinking to myself, wow, that really sounds interesting. And it seems like another, you know, it involves the mafia, the church, and corrupt politicians. And so there's a part of me that goes, well, it's definitely the kind of film that this director likes to make. So I'm very curious about that one. So
hopefully I'll get around to it. There's a gangster movie that came out over here a couple of years ago, produced by Jonathan Southcott, who's the guy that used to write all the Hammer books and stuff, Christopher Lee books, and now he produces gangster movies. And he did one called We Still Kill the Old Way, but I'm assuming it's probably just the title and not necessarily a remake. But that's another one I haven't seen. When you mentioned the film of his you really wanted to see, I assumed you were going to say Nudi per Vivere.
I wouldn't be against that one either, yeah.
Otherwise, I think that translates as Naked for Life or something along those lines. Naked Lives? Oh, I don't know. I'm just doing that off the top of my head.
Naked for Life seems right. Yeah.
Which seems to be some sort of exploration of Parisian nightclubs.
Yeah, it's a documentary, apparently. So it could be interesting. Yeah. Apparently it has Chet Baker in it. So
there you go. Yeah, it's like one of those sort of Mondo period, I guess.
And it involves Giulio Questi as one of the directors
as
well.
There you go. See? Even if it's just about naked dancing in a nightclub, it's still got some points of interest. But anyway, so Early Petri is very well established. From what I can tell, he's quite left-wing, is that fair to say? And he's very critical of politics and society.
And that's where I think we can use that as a jumping-off point. Yes, from what I can tell, he was very, very much critical of the right and the established authorities, especially within his home country, as you might expect. And at the time he was making movies, 60s and 70s, one might understand very easily why a leftist perspective is one that he would espouse, because boy, it was a rough period of time. We've talked about the 70s as, you know, the years of lead. And that whole period of time, having someone make films critical of society in general from a leftist perspective is not that much of a shock. I mean, there were even some fantastic spaghetti westerns that took that tack as well, where it's obvious that they're commenting on modern day politics when, you know, in the guise of a western scenario. So
And I guess to in case we weren't sure, there is a scene quite early in the film where he blows up a Nazi with explosive boots.
Yes.
Which, like, is quite...
Do you have any questions, sir? We're establishing this right at the beginning. So.
Yeah, oh, it's great. So the main cast, we've got Marcello Mastroianni, who is sort of Italian cinema royalty.
Yes.
I think it's fair to say. Just so many films. I mean, a lot of people make comparisons in the reviews that I was reading. They talk about this film having a connection with La Dolce Vita. And I was thinking about that, and I think that's kind of interesting, because La Dolce Vita, obviously in that film as well, he also goes by his name Marcello, which he does in this film. So it uses his own first name, and he's also a guy in La Dolce Vita. He's basically kind of suffering early midlife ennui, kind of midlife crisis, and just drifting from thing to thing with not really knowing what he wants out of life and just being fed up of life and all that. And that's quite similar to how he acts, how his character is in this film. He's like, he seems to spend most of the time not really being all that bothered. Life is going wrong, and he's just so kind of, I don't know. So,
yeah, he seems to have, especially in this film, his character seems to have reached a point where he's kind of accepting the things that are not going well in his life, because he can't really see a path where he can fix them. So, yeah.
Yeah, so he's just sort of, yeah, he's just sort of whatever. Again, another actor who's made loads of classic films, and many of which I've never seen. I have seen him in a few other movies, but do you have any particular favorites? Is he an actor that you've watched much of?
I have to say that I've not seen the vast majority of his films, which is a real shame. Though, of course, what I came, yeah, I know who could at this point. There's so many of them, but I have to say that I always identify him with that character that he played in Eight and a Half for Fellini.
Oh yeah, okay.
Where it's as I get older, I very much find it easy to identify with that character's juggling act. That he's going through in that film as he is attempting to figure out what in the hell he's doing.
Yeah.
The joy of realizing that, you know, basically having that character center so many thoughts that as I entered middle age seemed so natural. And to have him as kind of a go-to for referencing, well, you know, not, you know, everybody kind of feels this way. Everybody feels like they're pulled in a million different directions and they don't have the answers to any of this, and they're just trying to stave off disaster at every point and get something done, even if they're just trying to fool everyone into thinking they know what they're doing. So I always associate him with that, and so it's not much of a stretch as far as I'm concerned to see him. It's almost like a very similar character here, where he has reached that point where he's, you know, laying in bed looking at the television as the furniture is being repossessed around him, and he just asks the people, "Hey, look, do me a favor and take the television last because I'm trying to watch this." Okay.
Oh, they take away all his comic books.
Oh, I know. He's a comic book fanatic, and I love this in this future. You know, this future 21st century time period. These are called classics, and I'm like. We're there with that. That's true.
There's so much about this future that's just come true already.
Uh-huh.
In fact, I've got a quote here. I'm looking at the Matt Blake sci-fi book that we used last time.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a quotation where Elio Petri gave an interview as they were talking about the production of the film. And he said, it's a story set in the future. Men and women are much like they are now, even if they're dressed differently. Their cars are electric, and they live in automated houses which, sensible to the most subtle telepathic influences, spontaneously adapt themselves to the moods of their inhabitants. I mean, we're kind of there, aren't we?
Sort of. Smart houses, you know, Alexa.
Yeah. Smart houses, electric cars. And, you know, they are developing technology that you're like the Alexa that, or you're even on your phones that can automatically sort of tell what mood you're in. And so we're kind of there. It's interesting. Yeah. One of the Marcello Mastroianni film that I really like is called Adore e la Campagna, known in English as Hungry for Love, which is about a group of prostitutes who went, there was a law enacted in Italy that made brothels illegal. And so this group of prostitutes go out to the country and open up a restaurant, which initially is supposed to be a front for continuing their brothel activities, but they actually start to discover that they really like running a restaurant. It's a really great film, and he's in that as well. That's one that I wrote about in my research several years ago because of its UK release. So that's one that I really like. But yeah, he's through Italian cinema like a stick of rock, this guy. Really amazing. And I did actually, I went to his grave a couple of years ago when I was in Italy, in Rome. I found there's a big cemetery, and you can get a map of all the celebrities that are buried there. And I did actually find him. And it's, considering his sort of importance and fame, it's actually very understated, it's quite small. But anyway, yeah, he's great. We've also got, of course, Ursula Andress,
mm-hmm.
Who I think she made this the same year that she made She.
I think so, Hammer. Yeah.
But so she was doing, obviously she's Swedish, right?
Mm-hmm.
I believe. But as after doing James Bond, she mostly seemed to do European film. That's what she sort of seems to have spent most of her time doing.
Yeah, I think that was where she was most comfortable. Yeah, she did do the occasional. I mean, she did a, you know, she was in an Elvis movie and a Western with Dean Martin and, you know, a few members of the Rat Pack and stuff like that. But yeah, I think that a lot of her films were made in Europe. I think that just may be where she was more comfortable. So.
Yeah. One of my favorites is Slave of the Cannibal God.
Yeah, yeah. I have to admit, that was the second movie. That was the second movie I ever saw her in after Dr. No. Oh, okay. So.
Yeah,
I am a trash fanatic, let's be honest. So.
Hey, there's no... Yeah, I think
Wait a minute, fine. No, I saw her in Clash of the Titans in the theater. What am I saying?
Yeah, that's probably the film I saw her in before Dr. No, because I would have been about 5 years old when Clash of the Titans came out.
Yeah.
So... that's most likely the film that I would have seen her in first. But yeah, obviously she's done a lot of sort of cult film. Like there's that one where she plays a nurse. I think that's Italian as well, isn't it?
What, mean the sensual nurse?
Yeah, she's like a sexy nurse. I don't know. Anyway, she's great and obviously just sort of iconic.
Yes.
Well,
I have to admit, though,
she does.
Have you seen, I mean, have you seen a lot of her movies? Because I got to be honest, this is the first movie of hers that I've seen where she's, you know, she's centered. She's the co-lead. And yeah. This is the first movie I've seen of her where I felt like, whoa, man, this is, maybe I need to pay more attention to the movies where she had a large role, because she's perfectly cast here, because there's always a certain, not that she couldn't present as warm in a characterization on screen, but she's really, really comfortable in that icy blonde kind of presentation of herself.
Yeah.
And that is definitely what she is here until it helps, because we have the confusion of whether or not she's being honest at certain points.
Yeah.
With
I gave up trying to figure that out by the end.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, because until the credits roll, we're not going to know. Yeah,
you're dead. No, you're dead. I love you. No, I'm going to kill you. Oh, okay.
Well, I love the fact that she, you know, it may be that she did love him, but was going to kill him anyway. But who knows?
Yeah,
you know.
I know. Yeah, yeah. She's fab. And also, perhaps in a sort of supporting role, she's only in about two or three scenes, but it's worth mentioning Elsa Martinelli.
Yes,
because
yes.
of her significance. In cult Italian cinema. Do you have a particular favorite film that you've seen her in?
Oh my goodness, I hadn't even thought about
that.
Is
that too hard to ask?
I mean, well, that's just it. She was in so many... I've seen her in so many freaking movies. I mean, I think she was fantastic. I have to admit, I think the first film I ever saw her in as a very young boy was the John Wayne film, Hatari. Which,
oh, okay.
Yeah, and she's...
Yeah.
She's great in that, but at the same time, she's literally the only woman in the cast.
Right.
unless you count the animals, you know.
Quite easy to notice. I mean, many people would be familiar with her, I guess, from One on Top of the Other.
Yeah, yeah.
The Fulci film. She did one of the OSS 117 films.
Yes, which I still haven't watched. I've got to do that.
I don't think I've seen that. Yeah, I haven't seen that one. I've seen a few of those, but yeah, again, like Mastroianni, she's just sort of ubiquitous for a good 20, 30 years in Italian cinema.
Knowing that she was in Blood and Roses makes me want to go back and rewatch that, because I haven't seen that in forever.
Orson Welles' The Trial she's in.
Mm-hmm.
Just all kinds of stuff. So, yeah, so she's... perhaps one or the other, and she's quite a fun character in this film as well. She's basically just turning up, complaining, leaving, turning up again, complaining, getting angry on the phone. She's got some quite sort of fun stuff to do, I think, in this film. The last name I think we should probably mention, just in terms of the cult cinema and the heritage of this podcast, I guess, is the involvement of Ernesto Gastaldi.
Oh.
Who helped out with the script. So it's originally adapted from a short story,
right,
which I think is American, called The Seventh Victim by Robert Sheckley.
Yes, definitely.
Which I must confess, I've never read. Have you read that?
No, I haven't read it. I know, here's the horrible thing. It was adapted into an old radio show called... years and years ago. It was a science fiction... anthology radio show called X-1, and I know I've listened to it, but it has been years. Mm-hmm.
3, 2, 1, fire. Horizons of the unknown come tales of new dimensions in time and space. These are stories of a future, adventures in which you'll live in a million could-be years on a thousand maybe worlds. The National Broadcasting Company, in cooperation with Galaxy Science Fiction Magazine, presents
The changes made for, because it was called the seventh victim and this is called the tenth victim. That's a cosmetic change, but there are a number of other changes that are made to the story while keeping kind of the basic idea intact. And I would recommend reading Sheckley. I thought it was interesting that, almost any Sheckley, honestly, he was a really good writer. But at the same time, when this was adapted for film, Sheckley published a novelization of the film that same year.
Okay.
And then after that, he followed up with two sequels years later in 1987 and 1988, Victim Prime and Hunter / Victim. And so now I realize I'm probably going to end up having to read those three books just out of curiosity to see what he did with novelizing. The film, at least.
That would be cool. I had no idea. I'll look that radio show up. If I remember, I'll tweet out a link if there's a
radio. You can find it easily just Googling X-1 or just Googling the radio show and the seventh victim. You'll find it.
Cool. So just Ernesto Gastaldi came in at the end to help with with getting the script going, and then they made the movie. So. Obviously. So I've got a plot summary here, which we can have a go at. This is quite a good one from Matt Blake. Although there's also a very good plot summary in Variety, and also the Monthly Film Bulletin, because it did get a decent release. As far as I can tell, I've now watched this with Italian language and subtitles, and also the English language track. I'm fairly sure it was shot primarily to be shown in English. Because that's what the lips seemed to sync most of the time with the English track.
Huh, that's interesting. I hadn't thought about that.
I think that may have helped with the release in the UK and the US. Although one review I read said that at times it flipped back to Italian and had subtitles.
Now the version I watched is the version of the film that is just streaming on Tubi here in the United States.
Okay.
And it's in Italian with subtitles the whole time. I mean, there are a few moments, just a couple of lines of dialogue here where somebody slips in a piece of English dialogue, a little thing here or there, but otherwise it was in Italian, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, so I think it looks to me like it was shot to be in English, which was obviously, there was a lot of commercial Italian cinema that was shot to be spoken English first. Mm-hmm. I think. Anyway, so the narrative is set in the 21st century when violence is legalized in the form of an elaborate game called the Big Hunt. Each hunter has to play 10 rounds, 5 as a hunter, 5 as the hunted. And I think they alternate, so they take it in turns to be a hunter and the hunted.
Right.
Hunter, hunted, hunter, hunted. The hunter knows everything about their victim, and it's their job to track them down and kill them. The hunted knows nothing about the person on their trail, so they have to work out who it might be and dispose of them before they themselves are killed. The victor of each round wins a financial reward, and the survivor of each game, so if you survive all 10 they get $1 million and prestige around the world. Now, this already sounds like a good concept for a reality TV show. I mean, apart from not the actual killing, but, Hunter and Hunted.
Yeah.
Somebody's got to have done a show like that. I don't know. There's a show here in the UK, I think it might be called The Hunted, where they have a bunch of members of the public who've got to hide while a group of scary ex-SAS guys like just search the country and try and track them down.
Really?
So yeah, so that kind of thing is actually on TV over here, but
interesting.
But I like the idea of just one on one, and I think it's a good twist that the person who's being hunted doesn't know who their hunter is.
Right.
They've just got to figure it out before they die, and it seems like the hunters quite like to take their time.
Oh, especially if they have, because they know they can take their time to a degree. They're constantly finding ways to make money off of this entire enterprise, yeah. Which I thought was yet another leftist stab at what this could obviously turn into.
Yeah, and also some of the hunters that we see on screen are just really bad shots.
Yes, I did wonder just how much training was put into place for these people to actually become decent marksmen. Yeah.
Yeah. Cause the opening scene is in New York where, we see a guy, we don't know who he is, but he's chasing a woman through the streets of New York and he just keeps shooting at her and he's not getting anywhere close. And she just kind of leads him until eventually they go into a club where he walks in and suddenly we're in a pop art universe. Mm-hmm. We're off the New York streets and we're in a club where it looks a little bit like they've walked into an Apple store because everything is white.
Well, that's what the future's going to look like, Adrian. Yeah. Don't you know that?
But it turns out to be some kind of cabaret, and all of a sudden this beautiful masked woman in a silver bikini is doing this cabaret show which just involves slapping the men that are watching her around the face.
True, and them taking it with slight grins on their faces, yes.
Yeah, until she gets to the guy who was the hunter, and then she shoots him, and this is, I think, quite an iconic image. She shoots him.
Stolen wholesale for Austin Powers, yes.
Yes. I was also wondering, do they do this in Dr. Goldfoot, or have I just confused that with Austin Powers?
You know, it's very possible, but I have to admit, yeah, I have yet to ever make it all the way through both of those movies.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I don't know whether, the Goldfoot thing, or if it's just Austin Powers rips off Goldfoot and this, but it's such an iconic moment that I was going to mention the Blu-ray of this in the UK, which was put out about 10 years ago now by Shameless. It's got a really nice lenticular cover with Ursula Andress in her bikini, and if you move it around, it fires bullets at the guy on the front cover. She's firing. They've done it so that she's firing at Marcello, and it's pretty funny.
That anyway. Is funny.
So yeah, so that's a good moment. One thing that this film doesn't give us is any blood. People are getting shot all the time, but this is the kind of film, a bit like old westerns, where they just fall over and die.
Yeah.
This is,
It almost
this
seems
is pre
like
the Wild Bunch.
It's definitely. It's almost as if the visual look would have been marred by having those splashes of red on a lot of this stuff.
Yeah,
although
sometimes because it's so colorful, it would have like looked quite cool in this white Apple Store.
Well, yeah, but it would have looked interesting, bright red. But at the same time, it also would have looked visually out of place, because
that's true.
There's at a certain point there's a woman who gets shot on the steps of a building and she's dressed she's in a white dress, and it's it's almost as if they wanted to maintain that white color against the slightly different color of the steps instead of having a splash of red across it.
It seems an artistic choice
rather than anything else.
She runs up the steps towards Marcello because it's actually the headquarters. It's like the Italian, the Rome headquarters of the big hunt,
mm-hmm.
like Hunt HQ. And she's being chased by a hunter. But then she gets shot on the steps, and then the hunter gets done by the police for being illegally parked.
Yes.
There's quite a lot of stuff where, because they're hunters and hunted, they can just kill people out in broad daylight, and all the passers-by are like totally fine with it.
Well, that seems very much like a commentary on society's acceptance of violence altogether, because almost no one seems at all bothered by the fact that there are people running around very near them with guns shooting at other people.
Yeah, there's a few times, isn't there, where we just see that in the background.
Yeah.
Like someone's walking along having a conversation, and behind them, two guys are shooting at each other. And there's a bit in a restaurant, like this rooftop restaurant, where two guys come in and start chasing each other, and the maitre d' just chases them out and says, you know, no hunting on the premises.
And yeah, there was a sign posted. And
yeah. So we get to Marcello, who we discover is one of the best hunters in the game, mm-hmm. when he blows up a Nazi jockey before he gets on his horse, because he's put bombs in his boots, and it's when he clicks his boots together in the doing a Nazi salute that he gets blown to bits.
Hard to not recognize the comment made there. So.
Yeah, but he's becoming jaded with the whole thing. He's in financial mess because he's just gone through a very messy... in the future, they don't get divorced. They just get their weddings annulled.
Mm.
And so I think it's taken years for this annulment to come through, but it's cost him, well, as we find out later on, everything in his house gets taken as part of the annulment. And in this society, people seem to have been married multiple times as well.
Yeah, so there's one character who's apparently been married 30 times.
Yeah. Yeah, he says, I came here on my honeymoon with, which one was it? Was it my 11th wife? Like, wow. Okay. Marcello is, as I mentioned before, he's got this sort of ennui. And he knows that he's now the hunted, but he just has to hang around and wait because he doesn't know who it's going to be. It could take at least a few days because this is a worldwide game. So Ursula Andress, she's based in New York. I don't know if she's supposed to be American, but her name is Caroline. So she could be American. But he's got to wait for whoever it is to come to Italy and find him and all that. And he's just really fed up. He's got some contacts, some associates who help him with organizing stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And he's got Elsa Martinelli, who's playing his new girlfriend, who's waiting for him to get annulled so that they can get married. Meanwhile, Caroline is on her way, but she gets approached by the Ming Tea Company. And they've got a great idea, haven't they, Rod?
Yes, yes. The idea of finding a way to lure her intended victim to a particular place so they can have a very big television spectacular when she guns him down.
So that surprised me at first. I'd forgotten because it's been a while since I watched the film. You assume with this kind of thing where, you know, in the future, murder is legal and it's the national sport and all that, that it would already be being televised. So I'd forgotten that actually this whole big hunt thing, which they justify at some point in the film, how this has stopped all wars. If Hitler had played the big hunt, you know, we would never have had World War II.
Mm-hmm.
So it's being used in the same way that we see later on with Rollerball.
Right.
In the future, this kind of state-sanctioned violence has got rid of all the other violence. But it's not televised, which seems surprising to me. So the big deal here is that she's going to get sponsorship from Ming Tea and get it on television. But I just was surprised that it wasn't already on television.
Well, let's examine that for a minute, because it does seem as if what the story is putting forth is the idea that simply having the ability to enlist in this game and participate in it is a way of controlling the more violent aspects of society. In other words, if you have those tendencies, you will channel it into, you know, playing this game. And in a way, I can kind of see a simplified logic to it, because if the people who feel there is with an ease toward the idea of killing other people participate in this, one way or another, you're eliminating a good number of the, shall we say,
psychopaths,
homicidal people in general. Yeah. I mean, so I can understand a certain logic, right? And so we never get a real sense of how many people worldwide participate in this sport. Do we call it a sport? I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, but if it is a large number, and it does seem as the movie goes on that it's fairly common to be out in public places and to see people engaged in this.
Yeah.
So
it's kind of like LARPing. It's like live action role playing.
Yeah,
they're playing video games. Yeah, video games in real life with live rounds and just in and amongst the general public. But the public are always very pleased. So like at the horse racing event, when he kills the Nazi, and you hear the commentator say, "Oh, and ladies and gentlemen, it's just been confirmed that a hunter has just killed his victim at our event today," and everyone's like, "Yeah, woo!" so they're sort of celebrities to a point, but not mass media celebrities, because mostly what they're doing is not being televised. But anyway, this great idea for her 10th, because this is her, as the title suggests, he will be her 10th victim. Or, I don't know. That doesn't quite add up, because they do 5 of each. So,
well, yeah, way, but if you survive 10, that means that you've killed 10 people.
So. Yeah. Oh, that's good point. Yes. Whether you're hunter or hunted, yeah, because you can kill your hunter.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, that's very right. I'd forgotten the rules of the game already. That's very good. So she's got him, and they've suggested that she goes and does this. And they go to Rome, and we've got this great helicopter footage flying around Rome. And they decide, initially they think about using the Colosseum, but then they see it, and they're like, oh, we can't do that in there. It's full of holes.
Yep.
So they settle for the Temple of Venus, which is just next door to the Colosseum. And we get some great shots of the Colosseum, the Temple of Venus, and all the buildings that you can see sort of next to the Temple of Venus, which is the Palatine Hill and the Forum, all the kind of classic Roman buildings. There's Nero's palace up there, and there's like triumphal arches, and you can just see all that stuff in the background. And I'm pretty sure that if you went and tried to shoot a film there today where you're running around and shooting and setting off squibs, you probably wouldn't be allowed. But there's moments later on in the film where they're just diving around in the ruins, shooting at each other, which shows a slightly... It reminded me of, was it Heroin Busters, where there's big shootout at a Roman baths, this massive Roman ruin, and they're just riding motorbikes around it. Pretty sure they're a bit more careful these days.
Probably.
But
reason they're probably more careful these days is because of what they got away with in the 60s and 70s.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. There is a... is it John Wick 2? There's a sequence in John Wick 2 where he's in Italy and there's a whole big shootout amongst some Roman ruins.
Yeah, but I have the suspicion that they may have faked up that.
Do you think?
Yeah, quite a bit, as a matter of fact, because I think that you're right that they would not have been allowed to do some of the things that they do in those films around those, those, shall we say, national treasures.
Yes. That's very true. Oh, funny enough, just this is now completely unconnected, but I'm looking on the IMDb at the cast list for this film, and there's the hunter who is shooting at Caroline at the beginning of the film. The actor's name apparently is George Wang, but the photo for George Wang on the IMDb is Vincent Price in Dr. Goldfoot.
Which means so George Wang was probably in that movie as well.
Possibly. It just brings it all full circle. But because I just saw it, I was like, hang on, that's not George Wang, that's Vincent Price. And it is. So she now is in Rome, and she has numerous opportunities to kill him. In fact, she introduces herself to him, and this is where it all starts to get a bit weird. She introduces herself to him as some kind of TV presenter.
Right.
And she wants to do an interview with him about the sex life of Italian men. And it has to be at the Temple of Venus at this certain time. And he's broke, so he's willing to do it if he gets paid, and she gives him an advance. And then they just start to play this kind of cat and mouse, will they, won't they, or do they fancy each other or don't they game, for about half the film. And she meets Elsa Martinelli, who gets very jealous because she starts to think that this girl is going to push her out of the relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And she meets the ex-wife, and there's just a whole section of the film where they're just kind of circling each other, and are they going to snog or are they going to shoot each other or what?
Yeah, because he is definitely trying to figure out if you know, because he's still he's aware someone is coming for him, but he doesn't know who it is, and so he's concerned that it might be her, because the thing is, a lot of these killers, they do just ambush people because that's one of the safest ways to win the game.
Well, yeah.
And so what she's doing, you know, could be the killer, she might not be the killer, but he doesn't know for sure. And so this is where I got, okay, confession time. I thought I had seen this movie in the past. Turns out that I had not. So I was, So this is my first time seeing this movie in 2023.
Hey, finally, I've got one up on you.
Exactly. I was going to talk about that at the beginning, but we were talking about other things. But here's the thing I find absolutely amazing about this is that I was completely unaware and just not ready for the fact that this film is, while being a larger satire of society and the way in which we treat and think about violence, it also is an incredible kind of dark look and an examination of love and romantic relationships, and it's equating this game to those, you know, to that idea, to romantic relationships. And I kept thinking of the whole idea of frenemies or enemies, friends slash enemies, frenemies.
Yes.
And the fact that once we get to a certain point in the story, they're enemies and until there's a threat from an outsider or from an outside force, and then they're kind of shoulder to shoulder against these forces, and that's when certain aspects of what they feel for each other start to be made clear. And the movie, we don't have to get specific about the movie's ending, but I do love the fact that it does play out very much in the standard, stereotypical way in which two people would end up actually getting married. This whole, the resistance and the desire to keep one's freedom versus the pull toward being actually in a relationship where you feel that you can trust the other person. And it's absolutely fascinating because that is not what I expected this story to turn into. And I do like that. I do love it. And I do think that the idea holds up very well. And it is a good parallel to the larger story being told. But what I find is weird, and I don't want to rush things here, I'm sorry, but I do find it weird that it is that aspect of the film sometimes that in contemporary audiences that seem to kind of push them away from it because it didn't seem to sit well with audiences at the time. And I read some contemporary reviews at the time, and they felt that that stuff, that center part of the film before the third act kicks into violent gear, that they had problems with. And it's one of the reasons why the film did not perform as well as the producer thought it would, probably. And that's really a shame, because to me, that is one of the most brilliant aspects of it. I can see exactly what they were attempting to accomplish, and at the same time, see why someone might not want that to be part of the story that they're watching in a cinema,
Yeah, I suppose, because you've got action in the opening act and you've got action in the final act, but then in that sort of middle section, there's not much action, which I suppose if that's what you've come for, you might be disappointed.
Yeah, but, I mean, it is ostensibly the stalking section of the film, but at the same time, it's not just it's not just stalking. It's where you're getting to know these characters better and see just how, the circumstances of each of them is kind of leading them into a position where this just might be, because they emphasize that, he's turned 40 and that he's, so he's essentially entering middle age, and he's not sure what he wants to, what he wants to feel about any of this, regardless of anything else. And, it's kind of fascinating. I was not expecting it, but I was glad the film played out the way it did.
Yeah. Great. Yeah. Yeah. I don't want to give too much more of the plot away. I will say, though, that so she's planned this televised thing. So he gets wind of this thanks to his assistants. So they decide to try and lure her to a place of their choosing. And they're going to televise him killing her instead.
Exactly.
But he's got to be careful, because if he kills her and it turns out that she wasn't his hunter, he can go to prison for 30 years.
Yep.
So you can't just go around killing people that you think might be your hunter, because there's a You know, if it doesn't matter about the moral implication, it's just the fact that you will go to prison. So he's got this elaborate setup by in a swimming pool with a crocodile in it. And they're going to launch, he's going to get her to sit in a chair, which then he presses a button, sends somebody flying into the air, into the pool to get eaten by a crocodile, which is going to look great on TV, apparently. This did remind, yes. I don't know if you noticed this, but there are some men carrying in a real live crocodile. It's not a pretend one.
No, yeah.
They carry a crocodile in and put it by the pool. I swear they are wearing the leather jackets from Planet of the Vampires.
Oh, I do believe that's true. Yeah, I did see a notation somewhere that those are costumes being reused from Planet of the Vampires. Yeah.
I was like, oh, look at those. So that's what I mean. Yeah, so we've got this sort of circling. He's got to figure out whether he can kill her. She's trying to decide if she can get him to come along so she can kill him. But is she falling in love with him, or is it all part of the game? Yeah, there's a lot going on there.
Mm-hmm.
It's a really fun film, and it just looks fantastic. Especially, you know, in HD, bright popping colours. There's one scene where she's wearing this pink dress that just sort of your eyeballs feel like they might start melting because it's so bright. It is a pop art movie, like I said before. I really love it.
Yep.
Good. We're both in agreement.
Yeah, I think this was, like I said, I was under the impression I'd already seen this. I'm so glad that I had not, because I wonder if I'd seen this in my 20s, what I would have thought of it versus what I think of it now, you know?
Yeah. So the idea of death games, this is something that would become part of dystopian future sci-fi quite a lot going on. Does it all come back to this, do you think? Is the seventh victim the story? Is it the kind of the godfather or the grandfather of things like Rollerball and Death Race 2000 and Battle Royale and all that sort of stuff?
It's possible. I'll say this. I think that a lot of this grows out of the idea of put forth in The Most Dangerous Game, the whole that old story, which, you know, of which there have been innumerable adaptations over the years. And it is first of all it's a fantastic concept, and it is one that's ripe for rediscovery and also ripe for reinterpretation and in almost infinite variations. And so this it does reoccur a lot, and so many films have direct connections to that idea that it gets kind of weird when you start delineating. There are all these threads. I mean, when you get down to it, I mean, futuristic Roger Corman car race film, A Death Race 2000, is very much in the same vein. You know, it's very much the same kind of idea, just, you know, with a lot of the details different, but at the core, that same concept. And so there's an almost timelessness to this. You could set this. I mean, I've seen variations of this set up and taking place in westerns. I mean, you could almost say that Sam Raimi's western with Sharon Stone and Russell Crowe and Leonardo DiCaprio. Whose name? Well, I'm blanking on the stinking name of the film. Anyway, you could almost say that is a variation on this to a degree. Although it, you know, the circumstances under which the violence takes place is different. It's very structured in that case. But it is it's always exciting, which is anything that involves that kind of, you know, stalking and potential for death on the part of the participants is always really exciting. And I have to say, what differentiates this one from a lot of others, I think, is that it's very obvious that this is being used. I mean, I keep hearing people refer to this as satiric, and it's like, okay, yeah, I can see that. But honestly, this is a very pointed attack on the society of its time and the way in which it reflects and infects romantic relationships. And that, to me, sets this one apart. Not just, obviously the pop art visuals set it apart. It's hard to find another film that tells this kind of story that looks like this. But it is those underlying themes, the ideas where they're trying to draw a parallel between the human instinct for violence and the human instinct for, you know, romantic relationships, for love, connecting the two of them in a way that it does bear a lot of scrutiny, and it is a kind of disturbing idea to dig into. And I think that, once again, that may be another thing that kind of pushes people away from it, especially at the time. I think this film has aged very well, because, you know, contemporary reviews were middling, and I think over the decades the attitudes toward this movie have changed quite a bit. It's one of those movies that I think has become considered better than it was in its day.
Yeah,
that's not much of a shock.
Absolutely. Yeah. And Matt Blake compares it with the Plitzioteski films in terms of its sort of, you know, the look at the way that violence is enacted on the streets, and, you know, just sort of violence is accepted, everywhere. Just people running around shooting each other and nobody's bothered, you know, all that sort of thing is quite interesting, I think. But yeah, so I did look at a couple of reviews, and it says in Variety, the Variety's review is generally quite positive, and then it just says at the end, weird but very effective. And it also says the sound of tomorrow will apparently be predominantly electronic and progressive jazz.
True.
Well, yeah, I'm down for that.
True. Those two saxophonists wailing away inside that.
Oh, that's really funny.
That was really cool, actually. I was enjoying that.
Yeah, that was pretty funny. I also had a review here. Let's just have a look. So it was released in America in 1965, but it didn't come out here in the UK until 1968. So the review I've got here, I've also got, actually, it's by, it was distributed by Planet Films. And several years ago, I did actually pick up an original UK press book for this, which is quite exciting. But they've really played down. It's weird. It's such a pop art, colourful film, and the press book is entirely brown. So it just, even the picture on the front of her in her bikini, it's a brown bikini.
Well, that's
so
weird.
Yeah, they were.
I don't think she wears brown in the entire film.
I know. They were just such a cheap distributor that they couldn't put any colour into the press book. But the monthly film bulletin review is quite generous. It says there's much to like in here, and it goes through all the detail. They particularly highlight the cinematography, which is fab. Oh, we haven't even mentioned the sun worshipping hippies. There's that was a big, I think, because of, by the time 1968 was, you know, was like at the pinnacle of the hippie movement and its influence everywhere. So they pick up on that in the review and just sort of call them hippies, which perhaps, I don't know, maybe in 1965 they wouldn't have been called hippies. Did that come later than that? I don't really know.
You know, I'm not sure. I will say that I think that's something we didn't talk about, is that another shot across the bow is that sequence where it turns out that our lead male actor there, his character, his main source of income is that he has established a sun-worshipping cult as a religion. Yeah.
But he only does it to get paid. He doesn't believe it himself.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that is, I mean, it's completely impossible to miss the cynical attitude toward organized religion being presented there, which is amazing.
Oh, yeah. The Pope is American in this film.
Yes.
They mention. But I like the fact that, yeah, you've got the sun-worshipping hippies who are crying on the beach when the sun goes down. Meanwhile, they're getting pelted with eggs and tomatoes by the moon worshippers who are just a bit further along the beach. So yeah, there's a lot going on. It reminded me a little bit of The Final Program.
Yes.
Which I know you're a big fan of.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm quite unfamiliar with the world of, his name's gone out of my head.
Michael Moorcock.
Who's the Michael Moorcock?
Or you mean the character? That would be Jerry Cornelius.
Yeah, no, just the author in general. But I remember when I watched the film, The Final Program, there's some quite random stuff that just almost feels like they're just being weird for the sake of being weird. And it reminded me a little bit of that in places, especially the whole sun worshipping thing. I was like, what? it was already kind of odd enough without that as well.
I was just saying that I think that what it adds to the character that you know, the you know, the man who's created this religion, what it adds to things is it adds to the idea of him being in a position at the age of 40 that he's really unsure of what to do next. He's unsure of himself anymore, and we get that because of the conversation after the ceremony, you know, the sundown ceremony where. You know, he's been crying just like all the other worshipers, and he confesses that he has to take a drug beforehand to force the tears to come out, which I thought was fantastic.
Yeah. Well, there's also a great sequence where he goes to the gym, and it's run by, I guess, the guy who's trained him to be a hunter.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And it's like some kind of stunt school combined with Q's headquarters in
it's very true.
James Bond.
Well, see, that was another strange thing I hadn't thought about at the time. Anything that comes out in the 1970s was one way or another going to be
60s.
But came out in the 1960s was going to be referenced as some kind of point toward the phenomena of James Bond, and that's how people who listen to Troy and I going through the 1940s Universal horror films will recognize this name. The New York Times review of this film in December of 65, authored by Bosley Crowther, who...
no way. Yeah, good old Bosley.
Yeah, yeah, I know. He starts off the review by saying, now it's Marcello Mastroianni who's going the James Bond route in an Italian film. So he goes on and he talks about the film a little bit, and then he gets down to a point where he being Bosley Crowther, he dislikes the film. So we get to this, and he says, the decorative style is also built into the appearance and attitudes of the characters. Mr. Mastroianni is a blonde-haired, impassive semi-automaton who is the high priest of a cult of sun worshippers and has a passion for old comic books. Miss Andress is an icily metallic, stunningly gowned Amazon whose old-fashioned human impulses are ambiguously confined. But that is what's wrong with the picture. It is predominantly decor that has a great deal of chic and shimmer in it, but feeling is ambiguously confined. The art director and cameraman deserve every bit as much credit as the director for the brilliant cinematic gadgetry and stunning colors and patterns in which it is photographed. However, the emotions of the drama are chilly and remote. What it actually delivered in this particularly super graphic film, super graphic, I guess he's talking about the way the film looks, is a clever but patently self-conscious intellectual exercise, much on the order of that which Jean-Luc Godard gave us recently in Alphaville. The cleverness is so insistent that it soon becomes excessive and absurd, and the gamesmanship of the satire becomes too cute, too much a bore. So that's why I think that, you know, besides it being Bosley Crowther, and, you know, if he likes a film, you've got to wonder if it sucks or not.
Yeah.
the question becomes, was that kind of the feeling without being able to put it into words of a lot of viewers at the time the quote unquote cleverness of the self-conscious intellectual exercise, as he puts it, becomes just kind of overwhelms any entertainment value. Whereas I think as the film has aged, it becomes much easier to see those things and to enjoy them organically, the way they're built into the story. So, I don't know. I just find it amusing that Bosley Crowther was still around in 1965 to badmouth this film. So,
yeah, 20 years later, and he's still misunderstanding genre cinema.
That should have been, you know, crocheted and hung on the wall, and, you know, put in needlepoint and framed on his wall at home.
No, I mean, his review is spot on, apart from the fact that he's listing all those things as bad things.
Right, right.
Whereas the fact that they're kind of icily dispassionate is like one of the things that makes it good.
Yeah, his feeling is the aesthetic choices being made to tell the story are off-putting, and for us, they are the opposite. So
that's amazing. So, yes, I hope everybody who's listening, we'll have got from this that we both like this film very much.
Yes.
And I think it's a good start in this kind of dystopian view of the future care of Italy. There's much to like, and it's available out there. Like you said, it's to watch something called Tubi, did you say,
yes,
in America?
Yes, Tubi. It's a streaming
and
platform.
We've got, We've got something over here, maybe it's connected, called Plex, which I've never looked at, but I think it's free on there as well, apparently.
Yeah, so. We have Plex over here, too. It's just that Tubi was the place I spotted it first, and I was like, okay, good.
Well, there you go. So you can find it for free in a pretty decent quality picture. It's also, if you're in the UK or if you just want to get it, it is available on Blu-ray over here, so definitely worth picking up. We're going to jump forwards because I think there were, from what I can tell, just nobody was really doing dystopian future films between this and the late 70s.
Oh, they were, so, but I don't know about in Italy.
No, well, that's what I mean. Sorry, in Italy. So that's why we're jumping forwards to the late 70s, early 80s for the rest of the season. So we will be back in 2 or 3 weeks' time as we'll start digging into some of the more well-known of the past apocalypse films. So thank you, everybody, for listening to this one. Do get in touch with us. Let us know your favourite post-apocalypse films from Italy or least favourite. We'll probably be covering both ends of that spectrum across the season.
I would say, yes. There are many films in that particular subgenre that are both beloved and despised, yes.
I've picked 10 films, and they're in chronological order. And as we get towards 1984, it's really scraping the bottom of the barrel.
It is a genre that burned itself out pretty hard.
It burned bright and quick. So thanks, everybody. You can contact us by email, wildwildpodcast@gmail.com, or you can follow us on Twitter at @thewildwildpod. You can also find us on and buy us a virtual coffee. That's KOFI. The link is in the show notes. I'd like to thank Mike Totino for your recent donation. It's much appreciated.
Yes.
And when I've got enough, I'm gonna start by paying somebody to do us a decent logo, and then we'll see what we can do with that, rather than the one I just kind of made up on Photoshop. So yes, if you want to donate, we very much appreciate that. And let us know, like I said, what films you'd like us to cover in the season. And there's a good chance they're probably already on the list, but we'd still like to hear anyway. Rod, would you like to add anything else before we finish?
Please pay attention to me over on the Bloody Pit. We've done an episode on the Flesh and Fantasy from the 40s, and I've got an episode coming up soon on a couple of Machiste films.
Ooh.
Yeah. Mark Maddox and I talk about a couple of the Machiste films that are out on Blu-ray over here just recently. So,
oh, great. Which ones?
Let's see. I'll give you the English titles. Son of Samson and Samson and the Seven Miracles of the World. Now, of course, both of those are Machiste films where they try to pretend in America and in probably in Britain that actually we're just going to call him Samson because of, you English speaking people don't know who Machiste is. So.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, cool. Yes, we don't talk about those films enough. And maybe if you and I are still doing this podcast in about another 5 years' time, we might get round to a Peplum season.
That'd be fun. Those are a blast.
Yeah, I would like to do that. They're great fun. Anyway, thanks everybody. Thank you again, Rod. And hopefully I'm now going to play you you've already heard it at the beginning of the episode.
This is true.
I haven't made it yet. So let's pretend that I have made it and say, here we go. We'll be back soon. And now enjoy for the second time our remixed theme tune. Bye.
Bye, everyone.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.